On average, we disperse between 75 million and 85 million per year in grants out to nonprofit organizations, about which three-fourths of which stay in our region.
Welcome to Fresh Take, a candid interview series featuring thought leaders and innovators from across the capital region. These one-on-one conversations highlight the incredible work happening in our communities and showcase both where we are and where we are going as a region.
Good morning, this is JB Holston. I'm the CEO of the Greater Washington Partnership. It's great to have you join us today for today's Fresh Take, and I'm honored to have as our guest Tonya Wellens. Tonya, hello.
Hi, JB. Hello, everyone. Nice to be here.
Yeah, thanks very much for joining us. We do these weekly, and we do these to talk with really critical leaders in the region and nationally on a diverse range of issues, but a lot of focus in all of these conversations on inclusive recovery and inclusive growth. And there's really no one in this region who is better to talk with on all of those topics than my guest today. A little bit about Tonya's background. If I read the whole thing, that would take the entire time, so I won't do that. But Tonya is the president and CEO of the Greater Washington Community Foundation, which is the largest public foundation in the Greater Washington region. The mission of the foundation is to build thriving communities by galvanizing philanthropy and investing locally to maximize community impact. The vision is for a more equitable, just, and thriving Greater Washington for all, and especially for those who've been systematically marginalized in the region. That will be a great topic for us to discuss that in the intersection of the business community in particular today, Tonya. Prior to this, Tonya served as a political appointee for the Obama administration as head of global partnerships at the Peace Corps, previously served as fund manager of a multi-donor initiative focused on financial access and inclusion at the World Bank Group. She spent a significant part of her career working on USAID-funded capacity development initiatives during the immediate post-apartheid era in South Africa and the broader sub-Sahara region. I don't know if you've been following the fires down in Cape Town. It's a sad story. My son was in school down there for a while as well. Yeah. In 2010, Tonya founded the Prince George's County Social Innovation Fund in an effort to shift the narrative and build social capacity in the county. Hopefully we'll have a chance to talk a little bit about that, because that certainly was early in the move toward those kinds of funds. So I'd love to hear more about that as well. Tonya's on the board of Leadership Greater Washington and the Washington Regional Association of Grantmakers. She's co-chair of the Black Voices for Black Justice Fund, DMV's Black Justice Fellowship, and a member of the Prince George's Forward Task Force, the Federal City Council, and the DC Interagency Council on Homelessness. She was recently named a Hero of the Crisis by Washingtonian Magazine, the 2020 Nonprofit Leader of the Year by the Washington Business Journal, and the 2020 Philanthropist of the Year by the AFP DC chapter. I think we can just stop right here, Tonya, and don't even need to talk about anything else. Just a remarkable background. But thank you again for joining us.
Thank you for having me again. I'm really delighted to be in conversation. And as I was saying in the prep, welcome to our region. And I look forward to hopefully what will be the beginning of a great partnership with the Greater Washington Partnership.
Thank you. No, as do I. And I've been looking forward to this conversation for some time, because I think that kind of partnership is going to be critical for us, certainly, and I think hopefully for the region as well. I thought we'd just start, Tonya, by talking a little bit about a couple of things, a little bit about your background. So I have these fun questions, and I'll answer them too if that's more appropriate. But what was the first career you dreamed of having as a kid? And you're probably going to say global coordinator for the Peace Corps. I'm pretty sure that was probably.
You know, it's interesting. I was thinking about how to answer. There were two dreams. One was to be a diplomat. So I feel like the Peace Corps and some of the other international development work has sort of ticked that box. And the other one was to be a civil rights lawyer, which I sort of decided not to pursue, and to pursue this kind of work alternately. I think it landed just as well.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. Well, certainly the contributions are huge. I'm going to come back to the piece of advice question at the end here, as we have time. But I'd love to talk a little bit about how the Community Foundation found you and how you found them, because obviously you've done a lot of really wonderful things in the past. Maybe just take us through the journey of your career, if you don't mind.
Sure. No, I don't mind. Thank you. And thank you for the very generous welcome. The in the introduction, the community, especially in the last year, has been very, very kind to me and supportive of me, particularly as a new CEO. I know how much that means. So JB, I'm happy to be as supportive to you as this community has been for me. I consider myself like a bit of a local government girl because in my master's is in public administration, and that was the decision to, rather than go to law school, to pursue a background in public administration and public service. And I finished grad school, moved to the DC region, really in search of international development work. It was either going to be New York or DC or abroad. And I've done some work early, like as a junior in college and in grad school abroad, and I wasn't ready to go just yet. So DC it was, and landed a number of really exciting jobs in the DC area. First with the National Council for Negro Women under Dorothy Hite. They had a really important USAID contract that had me doing work in Africa right out of grad school. Eventually I went on to work for ICMA, looking at sort of the local government role, local governance internationally, then to the World Bank and eventually the Peace Corps. But all along, I had a home base in Prince George's County. So I've been home based here for 26 years and knew at some point I wanted to sort of get back into doing locally oriented community work, using some of the skills I've gained and learned in development right here. So my kids were going to public schools here. I had my membership in PTAs and my sorority here, but I wasn't really connected or active here because I was so busy, traveling and doing the work abroad. And then I decided to do something here. I set up the Prince George's County Social Innovation Fund first in 2011, so exactly 10 years ago.
Wow, yeah.
And I tell you, it's so interesting because I set it up as a fund at the Greater Washington Community Foundation. Had no idea, right? <Yeah. laughs> That 10 years later, I'd be leading the community foundation. So it's a nice bit of, a beautiful irony.
Yeah. Well, that's wonderful. And thanks for that. Let's talk to the audience a little bit about the foundation, because many people do know what a community foundation is, but also some folks hear the words and just think community foundation. What is that? So maybe tell us a little bit about what it's about, how it fits in the kind of philanthropic landscape here.
Sure. No, I appreciate that. It's one of the running jokes in my family is, how many times a day do I say community? And I'll probably say close to 50 to 75 times a day. I'm so proud to be a leader in this community and to lead the Greater Washington Community Foundation. So we are a bit of a community development organization and a community development financial institution. So behind our community development front-facing work is really, a bit of a trust or a bank where individuals or institutions can establish funds with us. They can place their charitable giving with us. They can direct their giving themselves, or they can work with us based on the work that we do to listen to, learn from, be a part of this community, understanding the needs to make strategic philanthropic investments. We are part of a network of about 750 to 800 community foundations around the country. We are considered actually, JB, a medium-sized community foundation, which is one of the things I wanna shift because for a region of our wealth, of our size, of our capacity, we should be, and this is based on assets under management, we should be a much larger community foundation, and I'm keen to get us there. We raise philanthropic capital, we invest it. On average, we disperse between $75 million and $85 million per year in grants out to nonprofit organizations, about which 3/4 of which stay in our region. So we are really And it's everyday philanthropists. You know, we have some fund holders who will open up a, you know, a $50,000 fund based on a sort of a lifetime event, and they want to, you know, place their charitable gift with us and sort of walk with us as we are making strategic decisions. And then others place multi-million dollar gifts with us. Or if a foundation, rather than a company create a foundation, they can establish a fund with the community foundation and let us support their charitable giving. So we have the range of partners and funders and investors who work with us. And then the other group that I'm really proud that we get to work with is just regional philanthropy. You know, we are a partner, I hope we're a good partner, with our peers in philanthropy as we are all thinking through, you know, how do we best both fill gaps and create catalytic opportunity to make it to build a more equitable and thriving Greater Washington region. Yeah.
That's great. Well, thank you for that. And I'm just going to dive in because you set up the question. So I'm just going to dive in on that. How big should the organization be? If you think about, you know, because I do think it relates obviously to the business and business support, that question too. Maybe you just start by just what are the assets under management? And, if you had your druthers, what should they be?
So we are currently at around 375 in assets under management, 375 million. That's a medium-sized foundation. I think Buffalo, New York is about 600 million in assets.
Wow.
And, you know, San Francisco, much larger than that. New York Community Trust, significantly larger. Chicago Community Trust. You know, we're just coming out of strategic planning, and so I don't want to give more away than I'm supposed to. But we should at least be a half billion.
Got it.
And trending over the next many years toward a $1 billion foundation. One that is more endowed than we currently are, which gives us the ability to pivot on a dime to both crisis and urgent need more flexibly. So right now, JB, in order for us to do what we did, some of the work that we did in COVID response, I have to convince a lot of people, and that's great for partnership, right? To convince a lot of people that we're listening and learning and able to respond really fast based on what the community is telling us. But I have to convince people before we can do anything. We need to be able to do things and bring people along with us as we go. And by, you know, shoring up our capacity to do that, strengthening our endowment, strengthening our, you know, unrestricted giving, we're going to be able to do that even more quickly.
Yeah, well, that's great. Well, I appreciate that. Thank you for sharing that. One quick follow-up, but sure. The Buffalo number, of course, is striking. I mean, it's, you know, a lot of snow up there. So, what has driven that in other locations? Is it just, you know, time? Is it, what are the factors that go into that?
A number of things. So having a clear stake in the ground around where you're going. And I'll tell you, for Buffalo, a lot of it was when they made the decision to focus in on racial equity and inclusion. I mean, imagine that. Imagine that this is part of what we wanted to talk about, JB, but some of the community foundations that experienced the most growth, I'd say in the last 10 years, decided that they had to. There was a period when community foundations kind of, our remit was to be good stewards of philanthropic capital and to do whatever the donor wanted us to do. And there is a bit of that will remain. You know, we will be a place where you can house your fund and drive your own charitable giving. But more and more, it's important that we lead with a very strong purpose. I say that we are nonpartisan, but we're not neutral. And that we have an agenda that is strong and forward-leaning, that is clear to communicate and understand. And I think you'll appreciate, again, it's so hard to know a thing and not be able to share it. But coming out of our new strategic plan, I think there's going to be a lot of alignment with where we are going and where the Greater Washington Partnership and your members are curious about and interested in, particularly as we look at the racial wealth gap and inequity that exists in our region. So I'm super excited and charged up. I know my comms team is saying, Tony, you'll hold up. We don't have the talking, we don't have the talking points for this together yet because we don't. But I'm really psyched about where we have the potential to go. I'm super excited about it.
Well, that's great. Well, that thank you. And thanks for sharing some of that. And my comms team regularly is like, what did you do?
Right.
Stop that. But that's really helpful and also very timely. So I appreciate that. And that gives us a chance to talk a little bit about the last year.
Yeah.
Because, you know, you did, I think part of the, as I read it, the accolades were because you were able to pivot and provide so much help so fast. Talk a little bit about, if you would, a couple of things. How did you go about that? You mentioned lots of stakeholders. And in particular, how did you choose what to support? Because, of course, the needs are all over. And then I'd love to just talk about, like, the next 12 months, right? Because we're not done.
Yeah, that's right.
Let's start by looking back, if we can.
No, I appreciate that. So I want to start by giving a huge set of accolades to like all the Community Foundation team members who came before me. We're not new in the crisis response work. Actually, in September of this year, we will be acknowledging the sort of the 20th anniversary of the September 11th attacks. And most notably, our Community Foundation served as community quarterback, particularly around the Pentagon attacks, and sort of sprung into action in the very same way when it came to galvanizing philanthropic capital, communicating, touching base, supporting the families who were impacted. So we've developed over, I'd say, at least 20 years, a reflex for, for community quarterbacking during a crisis. Some good institutional knowledge there, experience during the 2008 economic crisis, 2011 crisis, 2019 when the federal government shut down. And so we knew that this would be a role that we'd play beginning on March 13th. So amazing team that helped us to, you know, pull our collective memory together to think about how we ought to respond. I'd say that looking back, a couple things. One, huge, I don't think I can underscore the value of partnership. It's in your name. We have community in our name. You have partnership in yours. But a community partnership is really what made all of this work for us. And transparency and frequent communication. And so, you know, we were on the phone every week with our peers in philanthropy. My team members were on the phone and our peers in philanthropy's team members were on the phone basically every day with nonprofit leaders and members of community that helped us to know what we needed to prioritize, what we needed to focus on, you know, which communities were experiencing what and how we ought to mobilize. And then JB, we put together this really rudimentary Google Doc and shared everything across philanthropy. We shared who was funding what, at what level. We broke it out. We had all the nonprofits we were supporting, who was working together on specific issues. We created work groups. And we really, the amount of sharing and transparency and communication is really what led to our ability to raise a $10.5 million fund. That's the one I think that gets the most attention in the media. But we also set up $30 million in parallel funds that supported a broad range of issues, you know, from Care First establishing a fund to support PPE throughout the region to Clyde's Restaurant, for example, setting up a fund to support their employees. And then we tracked an additional $25 million that our peers in philanthropy were funding outside of us. So we had a purview over, you know, $65 million that was going to nonprofits, to organizations across our region. Like, we really moved and acted like a regional partnership. Mm-hmm. And I think I know that for sure that the nonprofits are grateful that we were so organized. We lowered barriers to applications. We turned things around at a far more faster pace than ever before. I think philanthropy shifted and we changed because we needed to, and because the crisis called us to. So I'm really proud of the partnership that we were able to leverage across our philanthropic partners and with our corporate partners. I'll have to acknowledge them as well. You know, companies stepped up. We received for the COVID response fund, we counted about 1,500 individual gifts ranging in from $50 to $1 million. But, you know, of course, the larger gifts were from our corporate partners who, you know, called us saying, we trust you all. We know that you're listening and we want to place our resources with you all. So from the from Amazon to the banking industry to companies who, you know, had no real footprint here in the greater Washington region, but they saw our numbers we were battling a lot of crises here, right? We were in the middle of a lot of political turmoil. Our COVID numbers were high and we were hit really hard from an economic perspective. And so there were, you know, we got funds that came via the New York Community Trust, that came via Silicon Valley Community Foundation, and landed here with us. We had a few folk who attended local school systems here and said, hey, there's lots of resources flowing out here in the West Coast. I want to make sure that our people in the greater Washington region are covered. And so they sent their resources our way. So I'm incredibly grateful for the generosity, but also for the recognition that, you know, our region is special and unique. And deserves and requires a different level of care. And I think it was significant that there was so much political crises that the George Floyd murder happened while we were all sitting at home. You know, that people were not sure about where they would get their, you know, next meal in a lot of ways. And there was a lot of care about, you know, our people here in this region, so.
Yeah. If you think about the process you use to collaborate with all those other parties in order to pull the funds together quickly and decide where they were gonna go, et cetera.
Yeah.
And the Google Docs are great story, I love that. What are the lessons going forward? Because, you know, it is easy for everyone to fall back to kind of the old methods of grant making and lack of collaboration in many cases.
Right. Yeah, it's so, it's interesting because when we were around December-ish after the elections, we had one of our last really big meetings with our COVID response steering committee. And I said, it feels like we're breaking up. Because we were breaking up a little bit, you know. It's hard to maintain such a high level of engagement for a sustained period of time. But there are some lessons that we have to go back to. I think we all had to go back and sort out our own homes and, you know, figure out work situations, return to work policies, just things that we didn't have a chance to take care of in the, you know, preceding 11 months. We're all sorting those things out now. And my hope is that we'll come together. But there's some things around transparency of information that is galvanizing. Just knowing who's doing what in real time. Mm-hmm. You know, we can't wait for this sort of 1 year annual report that's backward looking to help, you know, guide day-to-day decisions. Like, you need access to a tool, again, as simple as it needs to be, that gives us real time about who's doing what so that you can figure out how to leverage it, build on it, you know, not duplicate. Like, that to me was one of the most, that is the most simple thing that we can do going forward. And then You know, just being clear that we're in partnership and not in competition, that we get to share, I think, both the burden and the accolades. You know, I feel like, and I've said this to the steering committee, a lot of really nice, and I'm very happy, especially as a newish CEO, I won't get to use that for much longer, that a lot of accolades came my way. But it could not have happened, would not have happened without, one, the amazing team at the Community Foundation, and then two, without the partnership and trust of our peers in philanthropy. And I won't name them because I won't get to name all the names, but they're all on our website. But it really required just trust and an effective practice and partnership in order for us to work together for a sustained period and to have the impact that we did. I'm very optimistic about what we'll be able to do in the future, because I am committed. JB, once you experience something like that, I mean, you know what it feels like to win. So you want to replicate that, even, you know, without the, because we have crises every day, right? I mean, we have crises of the economy and, you know, violence and discrimination and racism every day. And so there is enough already for us to galvanize toward different outcomes. I want us to pursue an agenda that supports that.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about the next 12 months or this calendar year, the rest of this calendar year. I think one of the things that a lot of folks in the business world had a propensity to do over the last 12 months was to think in a binary way.
Yeah.
About the pandemic, you know, it's going to be over at date X. And once it's over, we're back to, well, maybe the new normal, but we're back to. But I think the reality, albeit with a very different federal administration now supporting in ways that the last did not. But, you know, the reality is this is going to linger. And, you know, we've been saying that inclusive growth, the path to inclusive growth is through inclusive recovery. How are you thinking about where the needs will be greatest this calendar year compared to last? Any real shifts in your view?
Yes. And some have, you know, something to do with kind of how philanthropy will respond. A lot has to do, in my view, with how the business community has an opportunity to respond and to perhaps even respond differently longer term. Mm-hmm. And then I think, of course, there's a role for government. So I'll talk about philanthropy first. I think where we are headed is really around three or four core issue areas. We want to make sure that we're responding to the mental health needs in our community. That was one place we were trying our best, but there were so many other things, like basic needs, that took precedence over mental health. So supporting the mental health needs across various elements and aspects of our community. Vaccine confidence and accessibility is important for us. So making sure that everyone who wants to and needs to get a vaccination has the access and the ability to get one quickly. We'll start working with our local school districts on return to school plans sooner rather than later. You know, this is right now is the time to start thinking about the fall and what they will need from us, the broader community, to be able to return to school sufficiently. And a number of things are coming up now. I have a call later on this afternoon about those kinds of plans. And I'd love, JB, the opportunity to come back and talk to you about those, and even with school leaders, because it is going to be important for us to care, support, provide, be available to school districts. Because the return to school is an important part of our all of our ability to return to work, et cetera. I think the piece, I mean, those are the areas for us. I am so curious, and I'd love to hear from you, how the business community is thinking about it, because, you know, one of the first things that we were asked to do when the economy shut down was to get cash in the hands of everyday working people, because they didn't have enough money. And this is pre-pandemic, JV, where, you know, wages had not kept up with the cost of living in our region. Like, you know, we have a housing crisis for one of a couple of reasons, right? And one of which is that it's too expensive for hourly workers who we have come to depend on to make it for 2 weeks when things fall apart. And that's not a normal that any of us should aspire to return to. You know, one of the things that I find curious is that I've read some of the local publications that some employers are having a hard time luring people back to work because the social safety net is paying more than a return. That's a problem. That is not the individual's problem, right? Like, that's a systemic problem. If your social safety net can pay you more, then all of the potential benefits of returning to work, right? So that means that it's not just the wage, but perhaps it's absent paid leave or healthcare benefits, certainly probably not a 401k contribution, because all of those things packaged would make returning to work far more attractive, right? Than having to rely on the social safety net. And so I'm curious about how employers are thinking about, you know, what can be different or game changing for us to return, but not necessarily back to normal.
Yeah, it's definitely a topic. And I think if you think about the largest employers in particular, particularly in this region where many of the organizations, whether they're federal government or other, are very information tech denominated, you know, it's very screen based. There is a lot of conversation about what's going to happen to the city centers. You know, if we're returning on a more hybrid basis, which is what it looks where it looks like folks are going. What happens, you know, if you've got 30% of your workforce, you know, only back 3 days a week or whatever those numbers mean, that's going to have a huge impact potentially on smaller businesses, you know, in Baltimore, in DC, in Richmond, and DC ironically more than elsewhere, because it's got a higher preponderance of those kinds of businesses. That will depend to some degree on the federal government. You know, do they require people to come back, and will it be 5 days a week, or are they also going to be kind of flexible in their work? So a lot of conversation about, you know, how can business collectively with the cities in particular address that? You know, are there things that can be done, not just support for the small businesses, but, you know, what does it mean to ensure all of them are digitally modernized appropriately? Do they all have 5G access in the right way? Or, you know, where are things that we could collectively be working on to do the most possible? Certainly, you know, there's a lot of talk, of course, as you know well, upskilling, reskilling, things like that. Those are great, but, you know, if you think about the kinds of small businesses affected, right? You know, it's you can't just run in and say, great, you know, become a drone operator or whatever it may be.
Right.
So a lot of conversation about that, certainly among the larger businesses and how they can help with that. And I think maybe this is where you were going a little bit, but I'll take you there anyhow, because you know, unfortunately, we're going to run out of time too soon. But as you probably know, the partnership collectively, in light of George Floyd's murder, in light of all the activities of last year, collectively, the organizations behind it, it's not the partnership per se, it's the organizations behind it, have all said, look, you know, now's the time to address these systemic racism, to address these issues. And as behooves large organizations, they're thinking very quantitatively about it. And I think surprisingly, they've said, well, gee, what if we set out over the next period of time to close the wealth gap, not the income gap, but the wealth gap, you know, what would that mean? What would that look like? And I think, and again, I, when you can reveal your strategy, it will be great to have this conversation more openly, but I think it's encouraging. I think hopefully everyone is encouraged to see, you know, an organization like ours, which represents a lot of the largest employers, saying that is a defining opportunity for the region. And we've been talking about it in the context of inclusive growth. And the words are intentionally chosen. Inclusion, yeah. I think, because it relates to that opportunity for equity, et cetera. But growth, because it also speaks to how business organizations tend to think about opportunity. You know, mm-hmm. if we're the most inclusive regional economy, we will be the fastest growth economy.
That's right. Absolutely. Well, we've reached the same conclusion. This is awesome, JB, because we've landed on a strategy that will focus on closing the racial wealth gap and increasing economic mobility. We believe that all of the other things are kind of the outgrowths or the outcomes of not having closed the racial wealth gap. And so I see some really wonderful alignment in the possibility of our working together in the future. That's awesome.
Well, I know we'll get into it as the strategy gets unveiled so that your and my Marcom people don't collectively right. run into the room saying, okay, just stop you two. But if we talk a little bit about where some of the gaps are, right? Yeah. What are some of the things that, where are some of the areas of work, if you will, that, you know, we're going to need to collectively be working on over the next decade? What comes to mind, just the sort of general areas of work where the...
Yeah, there's so many. I mean, and it's both the sort of looking at the pipeline of things that we need to sort of correct for from the past, but also looking ahead to the future. I know that one of the things that we all care about are building the pipeline for young leaders to be prepared for careers of the future. Absolutely. I'm a huge proponent of sort of education and supporting, especially public schools. And we have to think about how we're going to support their families and parents now. I do believe that while we're in this in-between of sort of the existing economy and the new economy, we're going to have to pursue various mechanisms of sort of a basic income that will give time and make some allowances for people to transition. I think we're gonna have to use an sort of an asset-based frame and look at what are the kinds of strategies that people who have wealth have used that we have to make available on a larger scale. Whether it's baby bonds or, some other forms of scholarships and investments in 529 plans. It's reparative resources that have been, that through investments in communities that have been, underinvested in for many, many years. I mean, we really have to think through the scale of investment at the same level that we've over many decades pursued disinvestment. I mean, many of the communities that we care about, that we know need more attention and that we're looking to address the broadest range of issues is because we purposefully, in some ways, disinvested. We've not invested them in the way that we need to. We're just gonna have to double down. And we have to do it in a pretty unapologetic way. This is where I know that some people get really uncomfortable by thinking about prioritizing businesses that are led by people of color, nonprofits even that are led by people of color, or even more deeply investing in communities that are led by. But if we don't name it, one of the things I like to say, JB, is that what gets measured gets done. And if we're saying that, all of these disparate outcomes are happening in communities of color, and we're not saying, but we're going to reinvest even more strategically and more deliberately in communities of color, then we're not really trying to solve the problem that we're naming. I believe and I know for sure that it's really hard to be poor and a person of color in the greater Washington region. Of the 20 wealthiest jurisdictions in the country, 9 of them are in our geographic footprint. And that says two things for me. One, it's a proof point, especially in DC. I think the wealth of white people is 81 times that of people of color. We got to figure out how to how to shift that. And we have to do it with a lot of deliberate action and a deliberate and deep investment. And it also says to me that we have an opportunity to grow a community foundation in a way that speaks to and addresses the broadest base needs of our community. You know, I hope for the day when philanthropy is not focused on basic need, you know, because basic need is covered, you know, through both some combination of government interventions and sort of the private sector doing what it ought to do to support workers and employees. So that we're able to focus on, you know, climate and parks and recreation and art, you know, those things that are additive to the community rather than sort of the basic need.
Yeah. Well, it's there's going to be a lot to both talk about and work on together, Tonya, here in the years to come. And I look forward to that. You know, one of the things that we're also trying to consider and your help in thinking through this will be really vital is the whole social capital question. It's as you know, we've done a lot of work in education, digital skills, the new world work. Oh, that's wonderful. And yet, you know, that's of course only part of the equation. You know, you can have a certification that's modern and not have opportunity.
Absolutely. I wanted us to come back and talk about portable benefits for our region too. I think there's a real opportunity for us that we should certainly explore.
Yeah, it is. It's a little astonishing that in this day and age, people have to get tied to where the benefits come from to such a degree. It should not have to be the case. There's so much more that we could talk about. One last quick question for you, if I might, Tonya. How do you define the region? Because obviously you've got a regional remit, and I know we all are a little constructed differently in that regard.
So interesting. One of the things I wanted to make sure I said to you before we got the call was that running a regional organization is hard. and for our regional footprint,
I'm quoting the philanthropist of the year in saying that when I talk to my board.
It's hard, JP. It's so hard. So our region includes Washington, D.C., Montgomery, Prince George's County, Alexandria, Arlington, Fairfax, and Loudoun. That's our sort of our regional footprint. And it's so interesting because I pulled up the language to share with you of how we are, from our strategic plan, how we're defining regional presence, because I think the language might be helpful to you too. So we say that the Community Foundation is a fully aligned as a united organization serving the entire Greater Washington region. And our board recognizes the value of local character and needs, the contribution of local advisory boards, and the importance of place-based strategies across the region. So it does mean both being regional in terms of identifying priorities that are cross-cutting, but then also having the nuance of understanding, you know, how some of our jurisdictions are prioritizing some issues differently and being available to support that prioritization as well.
Yeah, that's great. And I think to your point about school reopening, that as a category probably expresses as well as any how critical that balance is between the local perspective.
Absolutely.
Right.
And the regional. Yeah. But here, the other thing is, I know that I worked in international development for many years. And so if in the global context, we can think about sort of Latin America as a region, Middle East and North Africa as a region, Sub-Saharan Africa as a region, and work out regional priorities and issues. If we can do it globally, I am 100% sure we can sort things out at a local level as well. So that gives me a lot of confidence about what's possible for us.
I agree. That's what brought me here. I mean, I think there's just a tremendous opportunity. And of course, we're associated with the nation's capital.
Absolutely. And that matters for a lot.
It does. And I think if we do it well here, the rest of the world can watch and take note. You'll be back in the SDG international business before you know it, because everybody will say, come over here and go do that. Help me do that here. Well, it's been wonderful to talk to you today. My guest has been Tonya Wellens, who's the CEO of the Greater Washington Community Foundation. And I think we only use the word community 18 times. I was counting. in the conversation today, so you can report back to the family. Tonya, great to talk to you. Thank you for your work. I look forward to the partnership. There's so much that we're going to be able to do together.
Absolutely. Me too. Thank you for having me, and all the best with your sort of, you know, all the work that's ahead of all both of us.
Thanks for tuning in to Fresh Take. This episode was produced by Jenna Klein, Justin Matheson-Turner, Christian Rodriguez, and Nina Sharma. If you like what you heard, share it with your network. For more information and to access all of our podcasts, events, and publications, visit GreaterWashingtonPartnership.com.